Hey, welcome to Answering the Tough Ones. My name's Nathan, and I'm on staff here at Watermark. I actually lead the apologetics team here at Watermark. For those of y'all that didn't know, we have an apologetics team. It's called the Great Questions Team. Sometimes y'all see either in the Watermark news or just around, you'll see, you know, hey, if questions are keeping you from faith or whatever, you can contact the Great Questions Team. And so most of the time when people send emails, like myself and the team that I lead are the ones that field those questions. So welcome tonight. How many of y'all, this is your very first time to come to a core class? Raise your hand. Outstanding. Love it. How many of y'all don't even know what a core class is? That's what I'm talking about. Love it. So just a real quick contextualization here. We offer 6 core classes throughout the year. They run one after the other. What do you call that? Not concurrently, but sequentially, yeah. They run sequentially one after the other from the beginning of February all the way up until Thanksgiving. And so those core classes are cover to cover, which is kind of an overview of the whole Bible, understanding the narrative of Scripture from Genesis to Revelation. And then we offer the life of Christ, because if you're Christian and you don't know about Jesus, then there's a problem with that, right? So we offer the life of Christ, and then we offer keys to effective Bible study. That's hey, if we're going to read the Bible and look at that as a central text for our faith, then we need to know how to read, study, and interpret it and apply it. So that's the Keys to Effective Bible Study class. Then the last one we just had was our theology class, which sometimes scares people, that term does, but we believe everyone's a theologian. If you think about God, you're a theologian, and so we're trying to inform and equip people to think rightly about God. So that's our Know What You Believe and Why. Now, I'm understanding the essentials of Christian faith and how it shapes our worldview. And then the class you're sitting in now is the 5th of the 6 that we do, and this is our apologetics class. This is so for those of y'all who don't know what apologetics is, this is not something where we're going to equip you how to like apologize for being a Christian. You know, that's not what we're doing. That's not what we're doing. Apologetics literally comes from a Greek word that just means to give an answer or to give a defense. And so apologetics is just a transliteration of that term, that it literally just means this is our class that's going to equip you to be able to give a defense to answer, or at least give an adequate answer in the right direction to some of the tough questions that we experience in our culture today. So this is Answering the Tough Ones. It'll be a 6-week class starting tonight. So it'll be this all the way until October the 6th will be the last class. And then the last class we offer in the year is our evangelism class, and that is to equip you to be able to get beyond some of those fears in sharing your faith. And part of that class will also be to participate in one of the Unashamed weekends that we do here at Watermark. Anybody ever done Unashamed before? A handful of people. That's a really good weekend. So that for those of y'all who don't know what core classes are, I'm glad you asked. That's what core classes are, okay? We do encourage, and the reason we call them core is because we believe these are all the things that our membership, we encourage that everybody take these classes that we believe are core to someone growing and maturing into their faith. And so those are the core classes. If you haven't taken the other ones, catch them next year. We would encourage you to take all 6 of them. You also don't have to take these alone. If you're in a community group, we always encourage people take 6 weeks out of your community group schedule, mark it off on your calendar at the beginning of the year, and come and take one of these as a group. We've seen groups do that and have always gotten really good feedback from people, just because it allows you to be with your community group, but you're also doing something out of your normal rhythm. It kind of shakes the pot a little bit and allows you to get equipped together. So that's what this is. I'm going to walk through the questions we're going to address during this class. Tonight, we're going to talk about the just real basic question, does God exist? So we'll give you some good reasons to believe that God does exist. Obviously, we're theists. We're Christians. So I'm showing my cards at the beginning of this as if you didn't already know, right? And then next week, myself and Nika Spalding, who's on staff here as well, are going to tackle the question, is Scripture reliable? We found, as we do our Great Questions session on Monday nights, that's just an open forum where anybody can come ask whatever they want. We found that this is one of the really common questions that gets asked today. is, why should I trust the Bible? Like, it's an old book written, you know, millennia ago. Like, why does it have any bearing for me today? So we're going to tackle that question next week. Then in 2 weeks, we'll do what's the role and reach of government? Obviously, we're seeing two really chaotic kind of worldviews, and as far as politics go, play itself out in front of our very eyes right now. And so as we look at this and we're like, okay, as a Christian, like, how do I respond to this? How should I think about government? When people ask me about this, what's a Christian response to that? We're going to walk through that. Then September the 22nd is going to be a really good one. Obviously, a lot of times when you're encountering skeptics, they're going to ask a lot about, like, well, what about evolution? What about the dinosaurs? Or what about whatever? So we're going to talk about, hey, does science contradict the creation account, the Christian account of creation? And we're going to walk through various views for that to hopefully kind of at least calm the waters where they are stirred up unnecessarily. And then September the 29th is probably the most commonly asked question of the Christian faith, and that is, if God is good, why does evil exist? And what about hell? What about, does God send people to hell? Is it eternal? Is it all that kind of stuff? So we'll talk about that. And then October the 6th, one of the obviously pressing social issues right now is how should we respond to people who are experiencing the whole deal with gender confusion? What about the gender spectrum? What about gender expression? All those things. And so we're trying to secure a guy named Ricky Shillette right now. He hasn't totally committed, but if he doesn't do it, then there's another guy that steps in that does a really good job with that as well. So keep coming. All of these are obviously self-contained, but we would encourage you guys to continue to come. I think one of the things you're going to see as we go is we're also going to talk through this book, aspects of this book called Tactics. They're on sale outside. As you walked in, you probably saw that. I would highly, highly encourage, like, everybody to read this book. It's very accessible for the layperson. If you've been doing apologetics for decades, or if you just found out what apologetics means like 5 minutes ago, then this book, I think, is really helpful for us. So Greg Kokel did a great job with that. And we're going to reference that. And it's just good if you've got a working knowledge of it as we go. So as a supplement, I would encourage you to read that book. Well, any questions of me before we launch into this? This is somewhat of our teaching style is like drinking from a fire hydrant, all right? Or throwing plaster at a wall. Like, you're going to throw all the plaster at the wall. A lot of it's going to fall down, but some of it's going to stick. And the stuff that sticks is the stuff you build off of, okay? So I don't expect for everybody to be experts by the end of the night and all of this stuff. Would just encourage you to take notes as you can. And then the last thing I would mention before I pray and get started is we're going to do content now for the next 55 minutes or so. And then the last 30 minutes of the class, that microphone right there is hopefully going to have a line behind it full of you guys who, as I was talking or as Bobby was talking, you were writing down questions as we went. And so at the end of that 55 minutes or so, we're going to shut down the content up here, and there will be four of us up here who are on the Great Questions team. And we're just going to field questions from you guys for the last 30 minutes, okay? We very intentionally want a third of this class tonight to be interacting with you guys talking about this subject, not just so we can give you more content, but so you can see how we interact with questions as well, so you can see it instead of just hear the content, okay? So as we go, write questions down, be prepared. There's always that first question that's like really awkward that nobody wants to do, and somebody over the next 55 minutes better just man up and get after it, right? Sometimes when people don't ask the first question, we just skip the first question and go right to the second one. You know, it's a little bit easier like that. Anyway, all right, well, let me pray for us and then we'll get started. Well, Heavenly Father, man, anytime we come to stuff like this, I feel really inadequate just because I have a hopefully a healthy sense of all the stuff I don't know, and that's really humbling. Especially when at the end of all knowledge stands you. And so I pray that as we move through this content tonight, that the subject and object of our faith, namely your Son, Jesus Christ, that he would be exalted, and that people would walk away from this time both sharpened and encouraged and challenged, not to just get smarter so that they can have a better answer, but to know you more. That is the ultimate aim. And so we offer you this time. We know that I'm not the teacher, Bobby's not the teacher, Brett and Connor, they're not the teacher. There's only one teacher. And so we invite the Holy Spirit into this place now to teach us, instruct us, challenge us, sharpen us. We pray these things in the name of Jesus by the power of the Spirit. Amen. So one of the guys that's been faithfully serving on the apologetics team here is Bobby Crotty. He is not the Bobby Crotty that's on staff at Watermark that leads the men's ministry. That's his son. And so, Bobby, come take us through, does God exist?
Okay, so who's ever seen a cop show? Anyone? Half of you guys haven't seen a cop show ever, none of them? Okay, well, the good news is half of you are already equipped to make a case for Christ. Okay, so let's say we walk into a room and there is a dead body lying on the ground. What are some of the things that could have happened?
Murder.
Murder, okay, that's one of them. What else? Tripped and fell, yeah, accident. What else? Natural causes. What else? There's one more. How else could someone die?
Suicide.
Okay, so there's really only four things. In three of these, whatever happened kind of happened inside the room. In one of them, stuff happened outside the room. Okay, so let's take this. We have a guy lying on the ground, and then we have a pool of blood coming out from his chest. What does that tell us? We've added another piece of evidence.
Recently.
Okay, it's recent. What else? About the ways that he could have died. Okay, so if there's a pool of blood, it can still be suicide. What can't it be, or most likely? It's a pool of blood around his chest. It's probably not natural causes. If it was his head, maybe, but if it's his chest, probably not. There's not a lot that just kind of spontaneously bursts there. Okay, so let's add a suicide note, a gun, and one shell casing. What have we ruled out now? Have we? Have we ruled out murder?
No.
Have we ruled out suicide?
No.
Okay, so what have we ruled out? Okay, so we've ruled out natural causes. There's one more that we've ruled out now, probably. Accident. So it's probably not an accident if there's a gun there, a shell casing, and a suicide note. Probably not an accident. Okay, let's add one more layer of evidence. So we have bloody footprints, we have multiple shell casings, and now what are we kind of looking at?
Murder.
Okay, it's probably not a suicide at this point. So, just to cover what we've already covered, there are four different options. So, as we build a case for Christ, we're going to be building up a circumstantial case, and we'll talk about what that means in a second. But we're not just going to say, we don't walk in the room and just say, oh, well, this, so this, done, end of case. But we're going to be building a case over time. So, when we look at it, with this evidence, even up to the point of the suicide note and everything else, we can explain all of that by staying inside the room. We don't really need other explanations. Now, it could be, it's still possible, but we don't need other explanations to talk about what happened. But once we add these other things, then there's evidence that something has come in. There's an intruder. There's more that we need to go find out outside the room. We can't just solve the case from what's in there. Well, the same thing happens with our faith. So we have all these different types of evidence, and we're not going to go through all of these today, but there is all this evidence, and we're going to start building a case for why God exists. Okay, so beginning of the universe, not going to definitively prove that Jesus is Lord and you should all follow him, but it's going to start building the case along with these other things, and we're going to build this up. And what I think you're going to see over time is that we can't explain everything that we see in there, all the different things that are hard to explain. We can't explain all of them by just staying inside the room. So there had to be an intruder. You know, we can talk about science can prove lots of different things, but the thing is, what if you have something that comes and interacts? If I take a ball and drop it, it's going to drop 100% of the time unless someone comes and catches it and someone does something to interfere with that. So That's kind of what we're looking at. So we're going to talk about standards of proof. So beyond a possible doubt, we're not going to prove beyond a possible doubt, because there's always possible doubts. There's always, you know, even with the bloody footprints and the shell casings and anything else, who knows? I mean, we could say aliens came in. We could say unicorn came in wielding a pistol and did this. Possible is doesn't matter. So when we talk about possible doubt, that's really not what we... what we're concerned about. What we are concerned about is beyond a reasonable doubt. So what is reasonable? And what it means in terms of reasonable is, does what you know outweigh what you could possibly know? So there's always more things that we could possibly know, but does what you know outweigh that? And so this is the highest level that's used in courts. There are different lower standards of proof for like civil cases, but in this case, beyond a reasonable doubt, it's still a high standard of proof, but we're not saying that we're going to eliminate every possible option, because that's impossible. So when we build this case, don't worry about so much figuring out what each of those little things are, but just to make the point, we could say that there are 100 different causes that explain all of those 8 different factors that I showed up there earlier. Or if the evidence all points to a single thing, and we still could make a case for it possibly points to some of these other explanations, but when we have to use a ton of different explanations, and then we're contrasting that with just one thing that fits it, I think you're going to see that when we look at these different things and see that this intruder is not spatial, not temporal, not material, uncaused, and all these different things, I think you're going to see that it makes a compelling argument for God, and it's going to start to shape what we know about God. So when it says in Romans 1 that we know from the heavens and we are without excuse because the heavens have shown us God, there are a lot of things that you can see without even reading the Bible to know things about God. So we're going to talk real quick about the nature of evidence. There's 2 types of evidence. We have direct evidence. What's the other one that we always like to hear in cop shows? Circumstantial, okay? The other term for that is indirect. Direct evidence, eyewitness testimony only. Okay, do we have any living eyewitnesses about Jesus right now who actually saw him die and raise from the dead? Do we have any eyewitnesses about the beginning of the universe? Okay, so we're going to have to build a circumstantial case. Now, let me read you what they say in California about, or they'll read this to juries when they're getting ready to try a criminal case. It says, both direct and circumstantial evidence are acceptable types of evidence to prove or disprove the elements of a charge, including intent, mental state, and the acts necessary to a conviction, and neither is necessarily more reliable than the other. Neither is entitled to any greater weight than the other. You must decide whether a fact in the issue has been proved based on all the evidence. Okay, so what's evidence? Everything's evidence. You know what else is evidence? What's not in a crime scene, okay? If we don't find something that could have been there, or if the crime place or the crime scene takes place somewhere and it could have taken place somewhere else, that's evidence as well. So everything is evidence. Now we're going to talk about science real quick. There are 2 types of science. There's empirical science, which is mostly what people are talking about when they say science, and then there's forensic science. So empirical science just studies what is, what's repeatable, what's testable. Forensic science studies the origins of things. We can't do a repeatable test in a laboratory to determine who killed the person earlier who was lying on the ground. We can't go repeat that. We have to use forensic clues, and so it's a different process. Now, when we talk about science, we like to say that science proves this and science proves that. Here is a little video about what science cannot prove. And there's no audio. Okay, well, I'll just narrate this for you, and you can pretend it's William Lane Craig speaking. So that's William Lane Craig. On the other side is Peter Atkins, and you should totally go watch this video clip because it's really funny. But then the moderator is very much a Christian theist, and he picks on the other guy, and it's pretty funny. So what he says, the first guy says, do you make the claim that there are things that science can't prove? And William Lane Craig says, well, yes, there are things that science can't prove. And the other guy kind of smugly sitting there saying, okay, well, what can't science prove? So he says, first, logical and mathematical truths. Science presupposes logic and math, and it doesn't prove that. So the foundation of science relies on that. So we can't say that science proves something that science relies on. Metaphysical truths, the idea that the world is real, that you guys are sitting here in this room right now, that you're not asleep somewhere else and having this as a dream. We can't prove that through science. Ethical truths, you can't prove that what Nazi scientists did in the concentration camps is worse. You can't prove that scientifically, that it's worse than what scientists do when they're figuring out safer ways to deliver babies. You can't prove aesthetic truths. You can't prove what's beautiful. Now, you can study what is appealing to someone, but you can't definitively say that what beauty is or why we find it beautiful. And then the last thing is you can't prove science itself. Science itself has the scientific method at its foundation, and so science can't prove itself. We can't have a circular reasoning there. So I think we even beat the case. So making the case, you guys are going to learn a lot of stuff over the next 6 weeks, and you're all going to get smart on a lot of different things, but really we want to kind of take a step back and make sure that we're approaching this with the right heart mindset and that we have the right intent going into this. So first of all, you guys aren't going to argue anyone into the kingdom. Even if you successfully convince someone, your argument has not saved them. Okay, so it's God that saves people, God that changes people's hearts. 1 Peter 3:15 says, always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. So don't be afraid to admit that you don't know something, guys. There is a ton of stuff out there, and there are a lot of things that I don't know, and we can talk about the things that we do know, but ultimately we're not going to know everything. We're going to get into some good ways to deal with a situation where you really don't know a lot of stuff. You guys are doing great on bullet three already. You're already here. But continue to study. Go listen to podcasts. And also, that's not limited to just apologetics. When we're trying to make a case for Christ, Christ is still the most important thing. So if we're not daily being fed in the Word, and I say this to myself too, because it's hard to get in the Word daily sometimes, but if we are not daily being poured into by Christ and our community and getting refreshed in Him, then we're kind of just spinning empty, mindless words. Answer one question at a time. People will throw lots of questions at you. This is a big one, guys. There's usually a deeper issue. So a lot of people will have these intellectual arguments of why, well, God can't be this because of this, this, this. Well, it turns out a lot of time there's a hurt that's underpinning that, and it's a very real reason. And they may seriously be doubting with intellectual issues, but a lot of times there is a heart issue and a volitional issue as well as a head issue. So keep that in mind as you're kind of talking to people about this stuff, but a lot of times it's not just purely a intellectual objection. We talked about speaking in gentleness. So one thing, going back a point, one kind of diagnostic question for that, and you don't need to kind of just lead into this, but just a way to kind of be able to easily tell if there is something else going on is asking the question, if Christianity were proven to be 100% true, beyond a shadow of doubt, would you immediately fall down and worship Christ right now? If the answer is no, and a lot of times it will be, then there's probably something else going on. So last thing, get them to the resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15:14 says, and if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. So the resurrection is a huge piece of evidence, and it's also the central tenet of Christianity. So as much as we can focus on the resurrection, I love talking creation evolution, but at the end of the day, what matters is there was a guy who came on earth and he said, I'm going to be raised, I'm God, I'm going to be raised from the dead. Then he was crucified and then he did raise from the dead. And that's a very historically well attested fact. So everyone has to answer, you know, there's a guy who said, I'm God, you should follow me. What are you going to do with that? So the resurrection is a great place to take people to. Okay, so tactics. If you guys don't know, if you don't know what you're doing, best thing to do is just ask. So this is a summary of a lot of tactic of the book tactics. The first question is, what do you mean by that? So if someone says something, make them explain what they mean by that. Even if they say, well, I believe in evolution. Great, what do you mean by that? I believe in some things of evolution. I believe in microevolution, adaptation over time. I believe that species change and adapt. Do I believe in macroevolution? No, but when I ask the question, that gets us on the same page. The second one, reverse the burden of proof. How do you know that? So if someone says to you, you know, I want you to make your case for Christianity, you know, especially if you haven't said anything, it's, well, I haven't really said anything, but you have made this statement, so why do you believe that? Or how did you come to that conclusion? The last one, and this one requires a little more information going in. These other two you can use without knowing a thing about the topic, about anything. You can just always use those. This last one, though, is to make a point or guide the conversation. So you kind of have to have a general idea of where you're going with this. A couple of the other things he says in tactics is put a stone in someone's shoe. Your goal is not to just convert him immediately that night, but your goal is to just put a little pebble in his shoe that's a little bit annoying that he just keeps thinking about, or she, and just keeps wrestling with, like, hey, that was a good point. And a lot of times we all want to be kind of the harvesters and the closers, and we all want to be that Todd and JP who, you know, they're driving down the freeway at 60 miles an hour and they witness and someone gets converted right there on the freeway. I'm not one of those guys. I'm more of a gardener, and really we need a lot of gardeners. And so even Paul talks about that. Most of us are going to garden in terms of like trying to woo someone towards Christ. And ultimately it's not about us, just in the way that farmers don't actually grow things, they water. And so we'll do a lot of watering, but then Christ is ultimately the one who's going to save. And there's going to probably come someone else who's a harvester. And the reason that JP and Todd can do those things sometimes is because other people who are not as gifted at that, they have gardened over time. So we're going to talk about arguments. We're going to use these syllogisms, and I'll describe what that means in a second, but we're going to use these arguments, formal logic, in terms of we're going to have premises, things that we assume that are true, and then we're going to make a case based on that. So an argument typically has the form, it'll have two premises, so I'll just go ahead and put the example up there. Here we have all toasters are items made of gold. Okay, that's a premise. So if we're saying we assume that, and then we assume the second one, all items made of gold are time travel devices. Okay? Now, the third is the overall argument is a valid argument because the conclusion logically comes from the premises. However, that's not a sound argument because we know that toasters are not all items made of gold and that all items made of gold are not time travel devices. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay, so when we talk about it, the things that we need to prove are that it's a sound or that it's a logical argument, that the conclusion logically follows from the premises, and then we have to prove that the premises are true. So, jumping into the first argument for God that we're going to talk about is the cosmological argument. This is one formulation of it. There's another one in your notes that we're not really going to cover. Everything that had a beginning had a cause. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, the universe had a cause. Okay, so a syllogism, I said we'd talk about that. This is a syllogism. It's a logical argument that applies deductive reasoning to arrive at a conclusion based on two premises. If you can prove that the argument is valid and that the premises are true, then the conclusion is necessarily true. Okay, so we're going to talk about the first premise. So our first premise, everything that had a beginning has had a cause. This is the fundamental principle of science, what's called the law of causality. And let me take a step back. We're going to talk about a lot of science-y sort of stuff, and I geek out on that. I get excited about it. If it's not something that's exciting to you, listen to it and know that there are these arguments out there. But when you're talking to someone, I wouldn't necessarily just jump right into dark energy as a proof for God sort of thing. So if you're real excited about dark energy, go for it. But if that's not something that really speaks to you, kind of stay in your lane and just focus on the things that are personally impactful to you, because there's also how God has changed you, and that's not a scientific proof of things, but you know, if you are totally living a crazy life like JP, we hear his story a lot, and then God radically transforms you, that's powerful. So, law of causality. All that means is that causes lead to effects. And so if we're saying that this first one, everything that had a beginning has a cause, that's really all we're saying is causes cause effects. Science itself is the study of causes. So if we take away this first premise, we're basically saying that all of science is false, because that's what science does, empirical science. It studies causes. It's required for rational thought. Our thoughts, which are the causes, lead to conclusions. So a way to make this a little less controversial and to get away from some of the other arguments and still have a valid and sound argument here is you can use a kind of lesser version that still makes the case, but it gets rid of some of the extra arguments that someone could just really get hung up on. So a lot of times there will be these little details that we get hung up on, like, great, don't worry about those. There is a huge circumstantial case that's built upon hundreds of pieces of evidence, not three of them. So if you just want to ignore three of them, great, let it go. So this one you can use instead of premise one. And ultimately, something can't come from nothing. So cause, effect. That's how it's always worked. We see that every day. If I drop a ball, it's going to fall. And it falls because I've dropped it. Okay, the next premise. Now, so we're going to get into some of the more science-y sort of stuff. So there's an acronym, SURGE. This is from Frank Turk's book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Second law of thermodynamics. I know all of y'all got real excited about hearing about that tonight. All it basically says is that the universe is running out of usable energy, and that there's a, from the first law of thermodynamics, there's a finite amount of energy in the universe. So we're basically burning up the fuel of the universe. So to go back a little bit, we're talking about the universe had a beginning, so it started somewhere. So sometimes people will say, well, it's always been here. Well, if we have this fuel set up like we've talked about in the second law of thermodynamics, we're running out of fuel basically. If it was an infinite universe, we would have already run out of fuel. That's really what this point is saying. The other thing is, and we can make the case for order. So in addition to energy is running out, order is essentially running out. The second law of thermodynamics talks about things get more chaotic and more entropy, to use the $100 term there. If it was an infinite universe, we would already be in an infinite state of disorder. So the universe is expanding. Most scientists pretty much agree on this. You probably won't get a lot of pushback on this. Just kind of keep going quickly here. Radiation from the Big Bang. The Big Bang is the current kind of most accepted theory for beginning of the universe from a scientific perspective, and the only thing that really accounts for this cosmic background radiation. So that all that's saying is that when you put a microwave telescope anywhere in the sky, even if you're not pointing at any star or galaxy out there at all, there's a remnant, kind of the after effects of a huge explosion long ago called the Big Bang, that anywhere you look in space, there's a 3 degrees Kelvin, which is basically just 3 degrees above the absolute coldest thing that could possibly be. If that doesn't get you excited, don't worry about it too much. So, great galaxy seeds. So in this one, there are ripples in this background radiation, and they're very precisely regular. That's all that's saying. So then the last one, and this is the really exciting one, is Einstein's theory of general relativity, in case you didn't get enough of that in science. So this has also been verified to a huge degree of certainty, and if you take it to its logical conclusion, the universe had a beginning, is all it's saying. So we won't dig into that too much. There's also some philosophical arguments. If we had an infinite past, and we were going one day at a time, we never could get to today, because we would have, you're not able to actually in reality traverse an infinite period of time. So we would be stuck in infinite past, and we would never actually get to any day that we know of. There's also geological evidence. So kind of the running out of fuel, radioactive elements have half-lives. They decay over time. If it was infinite, all the radioactive elements would already have decayed by now. So that's premise two. So we know from those first two premises being true and the fact that it is a logical argument that the first argument is true. Now, people, there are objections to that, and we're not going to cover those today, but let's assume that it's true. There are a couple things that we know. This uncaused cause is spaceless because it created space, timeless because it created time, changeless follows from timeless. So if something's has no time associated with it, then there's no concept of before or after or change. It's immaterial, which follows from changeless and the fact that it created matter. It's powerful because it created literally everything out of nothing. It's intelligent because the creation and event and the universe was precisely designed. So we're going to talk next about the design of the universe, but just take my word for it for now. Then personal. God made a choice to create everything. So nothing continues to create nothing. And so we know that it had to be a personal being that chose to not allow that nothingness to continue, but chose to bring something into being. So it had to be a personal God, because impersonal forces don't make choices. So, teleological argument. I know we're going really fast. We will slow down and do questions later, but kind of try to get through this. So here's the syllogism here. Fine-tuning really just has three options. And all that's, the first one is all it's doing is just stating what those three options are. We can say that it's physically necessity, like there's no way that it could not be that. We could say that it's just total luck, that it's chance, or we could say that it's design. That's really the only things that we can say about the fine-tuning that we see in the universe. Now, the second one is where you're really going to have to make your case. I won't go into too much detail, but the best case for physical necessity is super string theory. And even it says on Wikipedia, the source of all knowledge, a complete formulation of M theory, which is one of the string theories, is not known. So they don't even know this theory that they're really working with. I'm not saying that proves anything, but that's kind of the best explanation they have for things, but like we talked about, it doesn't account for all the evidence, essentially. Chance, there's not a high probability that this happened by chance. We'll go into some of these actual numbers later, but there's a very, 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 very low, and I could keep saying very for the rest of the time, and it wouldn't really adequately convey how low of a chance there is for the fine-tuning in the universe to account for what we see today. Therefore, it's due to design. So that's the syllogism. When we say fine-tuning, we're saying that the presence of these complex and the delicate balance of these initial conditions given in the Big Bang itself, that that's what the fine-tuning is. So there are two different types. There are constants that are not determined by the laws of nature, like the speed of light in a vacuum. And then there are arbitrary quantities, the amount of entropy in the universe, the balance between matter and antimatter, the amount of mass in the universe at the beginning. So that's kind of breaking down a little bit what we mean when we say fine-tuning. So there are two areas that people go. A lot of times, Christians have in the past used biology to make a case for the fine-tuning of the universe. A lot of things more centering around cosmology, which is either the study of how things came to be or where they're going eventually, eschatology, end time sort of stuff, what will happen when our sun goes into its red phase and we all die, sort of thing. So, cosmic background radiation. We talked about it earlier. That's just, you point a telescope anywhere, even if it's not at a star, you're going to get it. This is finely tuned to one part. If it was changed by one part in 100,000, life would not be able to exist. So the idea here is that the ripples and the variations in this, right after the Big Bang, these really just microseconds, even less than microseconds afterwards, it kind of all expands out, and then the ripples, essentially, where some of the kind of high points in the ripples are, that's where things started to form, and where some of the low parts are, that's kind of the space in between them, essentially. If that wasn't precisely engineered just how it is, we wouldn't have life. And really, kind of, that's what we're getting to with a lot of these, is either the universe wouldn't exist, or it wouldn't sustain life. The next thing is the weak force, and that controls radioactive decay. If that changed in one part in 10 to the 100th, so that's one followed by 100 zeros. If it changed just by one part in that, then we wouldn't be able to have life. Dark energy. This is really one of the most, one of the more compelling examples, and this is where I said if you geek out on this, great. If you don't worry about it too much. This is, if it isn't finely tuned, and really dark energy controls the expansion of the universe. And Science has recently said, which really is to say scientists have said, because science doesn't say anything by itself, scientists have recently said that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate. So it started out, it slowed down for a little bit, and now it's accelerating, and they say that's because of dark energy. If that wasn't precisely tuned to one part in 1 to the 120th, so 120 zeros, then either it would have been too fast of an expansion to support any sort of galaxies, anything, or it would have collapsed back on itself because it would have had the force and then gravity would have pulled it back in. The low entropy condition of the Big Bang. So all this means is that there is a lot of order in the world, a lot of order in the universe. There's not just total random chaos, but it looks like things are generally ordered. The probability of that being the way it is 1 in 10 to the, follow with me here, 10 to the 1 followed by 123 zeros. So that number of zeros, the 1 followed by 123 zeros, that number of zeros is what 1 is followed by. So we're not saying 10 to the followed by 123 zeros, we're saying 10 to that number. So that's a really huge number. If it wasn't precisely engineered, we wouldn't have life at all. Now, the other thing is the ratio of these numbers together, and I'm not sure if you have this. Don't worry too much about what it says. All it's basically trying to show you is that the weak force, the fine-tuning of gravitational, and all of this other stuff, it's all necessary to be in precise ratios with each other. Otherwise, life and the universe would not exist. So not only do we have each of these numbers need to be these very precise, narrow ranges that allow life, but also they need to be at these certain ratios relative to each other, which compounds the amount of improbability of this happening by chance. Real quickly, irreducible complexity. There is a thing called a bacterial flagellum. I know all of y'all are real excited that you have those, but there are these little kind of rotary motors that move bacteria around, and they propel it. It is irreducibly complex, kind of like a mousetrap, which isn't a perfect example, but if you take one part away, it no longer functions. And so when we say something is irreducibly complex, that is, Darwin himself says, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would break down. So if you can't take, so the bacterial flagellum is made up of 40 proteins. If you can't take one of those proteins and show how that it helps this bacteria to survive better, and then you apply one more protein and all the way up to 40, if we can't show that each of those steps has a purpose and is useful, then there's no way it could have formed on its own because you need it complete, kind of like the eye. The eye is worthless without all of the parts working together. And so if you take away any one part, if you take away the rods and the cones, then you can't see it all. If you take away the lens, then it's not real effective. So if we're trying to say that the eye evolved, there would have been a mass theoretically that would have formed, or just this little tiniest part of something. We need all of the parts working together in order to have it all working together. So a lot of these topics we could spend an hour or more unpacking, but we got to keep going. Information, we don't have, there's no way that natural processes can create high levels of information. So if we just put random letters up there, that is information. But if we want to put up Shakespeare's works, that is a higher level of information than random letters. The information found in DNA is the highest level of information. You can classify information different ways. In this one guy's way of doing it, though, it's level 5 of information. So DNA has this incredibly complex information that is not just random. And so there is no natural process that just randomly over time generates the information needed. The other thing is we have all these chicken and egg scenarios. Like, for instance, let's see. Proteins are required to make ribosome machines, but guess how proteins are made? Ribosome machines. So we can't say, like, you know, it's chicken and egg. Which came first? Proteins? Well, no, because we need the ribosome machines. Ribosome machines? No, because we need the proteins. So we can't really just say, oh, yeah, it just formed over time, because we're in this cycle of it is kind of self-perpetuating now, but how did we get that started? Same thing with proteins. Proteins would break down if they're not protected by and exist inside of these cell membranes and with these enzymes, but you need proteins to make those. So Those are kind of the major arguments from biology. When we're talking about things being designed, so now we're shifting gears slightly. Fine-tuning, we kind of described that. Now we're talking about what are the evidences of intelligent design. So I won't go through all of these. This is a nice little acronym to help you remember, but there are these different characteristics that it doesn't have to have all of these. If we say a bird's nest doesn't have every single one of these components. It's not irreducibly complex. I can take away things out of a bird's nest and it will still function to be a bird's nest. But we know that a bird's nest was created by some sort of intelligent force because it has, I think it's about five of these things. So I won't go through all of these. If you want to talk more about these, we can do it later. So here are just some more examples, and they're in your notes. We won't cover them, but each of these is finely tuned within a set range, and like we know, it can be from physical necessity. It has to be that. It can be from chance, or it can be from design. All of these are so precisely engineered that have such a narrow range of what would be life-permitting that it's really hard to make the case that they are from chance. People sometimes try to make the case that it's from physical necessity, but a lot of times there's good arguments against that. So, you guys good? Kind of everyone catch your breath a little bit? We went through a lot there. So, next argument.
Yeah, am I on back? No, stay up here for a second. Okay. Because I want to make a couple of points based on what Bobby was saying. Because if you're like me, like I read on this stuff a lot. And I'm sitting over there going, this is a lot, okay? So I do want to give us a chance to, one, if you have any specific questions about the stuff that he covered, to be able to ask that. And then I wanted to make a few points before we move on to the moral argument, which is a little bit different. It's less scientific, more philosophical. Anybody have any questions for Bobby just about all of the geeking out that was taking place up here? Yeah, go ahead.
So, first of all, I believe in God. But if something doesn't come from nothing, how do you get to the argument of, well, where did God come from?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question for the Q&A in just a few minutes. So, anything specific to what Bobby was saying that you didn't understand or want him to unpack further? Okay. All right, cool. Thanks, man. So that was William Lane Craig was debating Peter Atkins, and he was talking. Peter Atkins was asking him, "Hey, is there anything? Would you affirm that science is not able to provide a reason for every or an account for everything?" And William Lane Craig says, "Yes, I do not believe that science provides an account for everything." And then he walked through those five different things that Bobby talked about. I don't know that it has a name. If you go on YouTube and type in William Lane Craig, Peter Atkins, things science cannot prove, it'll pop up. I know because I did it earlier. I want to make a couple of comments about the last two, the teleological or the fine-tuning argument. And also the cosmological argument for God. Look, a lot of times when you there's a deal called the Engel scale, and the Engel scale is this scale from like negative 10 to 0, and then 0 to 10. And what it represents is people along the spectrum of belief. So like all the people in the negatives would be not Christian. So a negative 10 would be someone who's like a militant atheist, who's like actively going against the Christian message. They've kind of made it their life's mission. There was a deal I was listening to just this last weekend. There's a guy who's an apologist to the apologist. He's like a non-apologist, you know, where he makes it his life goal to go and counter every Christian argument for God. So he would be like a negative 10, right? And then all the way up to like a negative 1 is someone who's like, I'm becoming increasingly convinced of the truthfulness of Christianity and am ready to respond in faith to Jesus who saved me, right? That's a negative 1. Someone who's ripe for the harvest, if you want to use some Christianese term for that. And so a lot of times when you encounter someone, if we're talking about how to respond to skeptics, You don't come with, like Bobby mentioned a couple times, and I'm glad he did, you don't come with a canned response to be like, well, I learned in a class that the cosmological argument for God, premise one, you know, da, da, da. Like, please don't do that, all right? One of the cardinal rules that we use on the Great Questions team, one of the principles that we go by is you never answer a question, right? Because questions are not asking questions. You always answer a person, because people are asking questions. There's a major difference there. So you want to first always engage the person. Figure out where they are on that spectrum of belief. Someone might have wrestled through the cosmological argument for a while, and that's their hang-up, right? Well, then I would say go there. Like, that's appropriate for you guys to talk about that. They may just need like a nudge or a part where they're like, hey, have you ever thought about this? That's the Columbo question three, right? In the tactics book. Have you ever considered this? That's the stone in the shoe that might be the thing that nudges them, you know, to where JP and Todd, who are driving by, can then convert them, you know? or they may be a negative 10, and you may encounter that person, and it may look like where you're just saying, hey, look, I'm not here to give you a proof for God, just like Bobby talked about the nature of evidence. There is no scientific beyond the shadow of any doubt proof for God. It doesn't exist, right? What Bobby is doing and what I'm about to do with the moral argument is we're giving you sound logical arguments that show that it is reasonable to believe in God, even to the point where I would say in my own personal life, I think it's more reasonable to believe in God than to not believe in God. Because I think the evidence outweighs it. So as you hear us talk about these things, don't hear us say like, okay, you have to be able to do this. What we're trying to do is to give you tools or at least introduce topics to you is probably more accurately what's going on. To introduce topics to you to show you that there are good, solid reasons to believe that God exists. Now we're 100, and all the things we're talking about, we're 100, maybe even 1,000 miles away from the God of the Christian faith. We are just trying to move someone from atheism or agnosticism to theism. Theism is not the same thing as Christianity. It's just a belief in God. Now, over the rest of the 6 weeks, we're going to unpack, over the next 6 weeks, we'll unpack, like, what does this look like from a Christian standpoint? But right now, we're just addressing the issue of, does God exist? Okay? So I'll move into the moral argument syllogism. It goes like this. If God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. That's premise one. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. Therefore, God exists. Under premise one, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. For something to be objective, it must, and I capitalize that because that I want to emphasize that there's no other way for something to be objective if there's not something over and above the truthfulness of what's going on there that the truthfulness is appealing to. Are you tracking with me? So if something is objective, then it cannot be true only in the mind of the subject that's observing it, which is why it's not subjective. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's not if someone is, and I'll show you in a video in a second if the sound works. Y'all can pray for that. that there's a girl licking an ice cream cone. Well, she likes strawberry ice cream. Well, the flavor and the goodness of strawberry ice cream is not objective. It's subjective because it's dependent on the person who's licking the ice cream. My wife likes coconut cream ice cream. I can't stand it, you know? That doesn't mean it's not good. It's just she likes it and I don't. It's subjective. However, when you come to moral values and duties, then there is an objectivity about it because something is true whether I like it or not. It's not dependent on how I view it. It's standing against something that's outside of it and above it, right? That's what the definition of objectivity is. And then I would say the explanatory ultimate, and all the explanatory ultimate is the explanatory ultimate is the thing where we, when in rational thought, you reach the end of your ability to explain. Right? So you can always say, like, my son right now is three, and guess what phase he's in? Anybody have a three-year-old or has had a three-year-old, right? Almost everything you say is, hey, daddy, what was his recent one? I think he was asking something about God. Y'all see the Jesus Storybook Bible? Do y'all have this? This is awesome. You could like do your devotionals in this thing. But his favorite story out of there is Jesus walking on the water, right? And so, hey, daddy, why did Jesus get in the boat? You know, because it says at the beginning of the story, he was tired and he got in the boat. And when he got in the boat, he fell asleep, right? Daddy, why did Jesus get in the boat? Well, Nate, because he wanted to cross to the other side of the lake. Why? Well, because there's a man on the other side of the lake that he was trying to get to. Why? Yeah, everything is followed by why, right? You guys have experienced this, right? At least you with three-year-olds, I know you have. It'll drive you crazy. It will get you to your explanatory ultimate really quickly, right? Because everything is followed by why? Why? Some of y'all have seen the commercials too, right? With like the investment firms that are like, are you asking enough questions, right? About whether, you know, how much you should pay them or whether they should give you money back or whatever. It's just why? Well, the explanatory ultimate is when you get to, that was it. That's all I got. You know, there is no other why to that. We've asked enough whys that we've now gotten to the end of our ability to understand and comprehend this issue. You tracking what explanatory ultimate is? So the explanatory ultimate of objective moral values and duties must be God. Okay, when you get to, and the reason that is because when you measure this against an atheistic or a naturalistic account of moral values, which is not objective by definition, it cannot be objective. They'll even say that. Then the explanatory value of atheism on moral values and duties gets to about here, whereas in theism, it goes much further beyond it. And anytime you're met with explanatory value that goes much further beyond another system of belief that only provides X amount of explanatory value, and this one provides X to the 10th, right? Then any rational person is then bound by reason to accept the greater probability of reason in its explanatory ultimate, right? So if there are objective moral values and duties, then the explanatory ultimate of those must be God. C.S. Lewis said this in God in the Dock, which I would recommend to you. It's a great book. He said, the moral difficulty is that dualism, and dualism is just it's a belief system. If you guys ever heard of Zoroastrianism, one of the most ancient belief systems in human history, but it's this idea of Ormost and Ahriman are these two embodied beings. One of them is good and one of them is evil, and they're both equal in their being, right? And they're fighting against each other. And the jury's out on who's going to win this, right? So it's kind of the good versus evil battle. And that's what he's talking about. The moral difficulty is that dualism, or good versus evil, gives evil a positive, substantive, self-consistent nature like that of good. If this were true, if evil existed on its own right no less than good, what could we mean by calling good good except that we happen to prefer him? Right? And what, in other words, he's saying, well, if I prefer good, then I can call it good, but if I prefer evil, I'm calling evil good. It's lost meaning. Are you tracking with me? So in what sense can the one party be said to be right and the other wrong? If evil has the same kind of reality as good, the same autonomy, completeness, then our allegiance to good becomes the arbitrarily chosen loyalty of a partisan. A sound theory of value demands something different. It demands that good should be original and evil a mere perversion. That good should be the tree and evil the ivy. That good should be able to see all around evil as when sane men understand lunacy. While evil cannot retaliate in kind, that good should be able to exist on its own while evil requires the good on which it is parasitic in order to continue its parasitic existence, right? So ultimately what Lewis is saying is he's referring to the objectivity of an ultimate good, because if you don't have an ultimate good, then good and evil lose their meaning. Good is good and evil. Evil is good and evil. And when good is good and evil and evil is good and evil, then you've just lost all meaning. You have nothing to compare it against. He said this. This was kind of his conundrum as an atheist when he was coming to faith in Jesus, or really moving from agnostic to theist to Christian. He said, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? If the whole show was bad and senseless from A to Z, so to speak, why did I, who was supposed to be a part of the show, find myself in such violent reaction against it? A man feels wet when he falls into the water because a man is not a water animal. A fish would not feel wet. Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed as well. For the argument depended on saying that the world really was unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my fancies. Thus, in the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, in other words, that the whole of reality was senseless, I found I was forced to assume that one part of reality, namely my idea of justice, was full of sense. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple. If the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Just as if there were no light in the universe and therefore no creatures with eyes, we should never know it was dark. Dark would be a word without meaning." Right? I know that's a lot, and I know it's kind of like, what? Right? But ultimately what he's saying is, if you're going to call something good or evil, then as soon as you call good or evil or say that you have a duty to do something, then you're now no longer in the realm of actions that are going on values and duties. You're now appealing to something over and above the reality of this that's telling you that something is good or something is evil, right? And that's the thing that Lewis is appealing to. The same atheist who says there is no objective moral good will stand firm on that belief until there is some sort of injustice that's done to that person personally. And then they cry foul, right? That's wrong. And which gets us into premise number two, right? Premise number two, objective moral values and duties actually do exist, right? Objective moral values and duties are self-evident. There's this idea for some people, it may be insufficient because it sounds so simple, but what I just mentioned about the atheist crying foul when an injustice is done to them, proves the point, is that there is inside of all of us a self-evident reality that cringes at someone walking into a schoolhouse with a semi-automatic weapon and shooting children, right? I don't know anybody that was saying, "Oh, that just was." There was no goodness or badness to that. It just was. But if you're thinking about the naturalistic explanation of morality, then that's what you're forced to say. That it just is. And so, even though it is really simple, one of the strongest arguments for objective moral values is that all of us have inside of us something that has a visceral response against injustice, against unfair play, against these types of things. And then I would say, too, sometimes you hear people say, like, well, this was our herd instinct, or this was something that was taught over time that we developed into. And actually, I would ask them the second question, Columbo question, how did you come to that conclusion? Because have you ever considered, which is the third question, the Columbo tactic question, that the vast majority of evidence that we have across written history of mankind, from the Chinese to the Babylonians to the Egyptians, to the Norse, to the across time and culture, you get what you get from the literature that has been passed down. If you will read human history, what you see is that generally these objective moral values and duties are the same. There are definitely deviations from them and perversions of them, but generally, no traitor has ever been celebrated in a society. You know, oh man, that guy stabbed everybody in the back. He's our hero, right? That's never happened. There's never been a time where a culture celebrated and was proud of celebrating the fact that they did away with their parents and grandparents, right? Now somebody would be like, well, that culture did that. And I'm like, yes, that happens in cultures, but it's never held up as something that's honorable. Do you see what I'm saying? And so we can say with pretty high level of certainty that objective moral values and duties generally span time and culture as a universal human behavior. Therefore, in regard to the syllogism, if God does not exist, then objective morals and values and duties do not exist, but they do. And because they do, therefore, God exists. So I think we can establish two really sound premises that a logical conclusion follows from. All right, again, this is just another, and we're only covering three of them. There's a bunch of these arguments for the existence of God. And hopefully, let's see. Let's see if y'all's prayers worked here. Nope. Yeah. Why is that not working? No.
Can be good without believing in God.
Can y'all hear that?
But wait.
Hang on, check this out.
The question isn't, can you be good without believing in God? The question is, can you be good without God? See, here's the problem. If there is no God, what basis remains for objective good or bad, right or wrong? If God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. And here's why. Without some objective reference point, we have no way of saying that something is really up or down. God's nature provides an objective reference point for moral values. It's the standard against which all actions and decisions are measured. But if there's no God, there's no objective reference point. All we're left with is one person's viewpoint, which is no more valid than anyone else's viewpoint. This kind of morality is subjective, not objective. It's like a preference for strawberry ice cream. The preference is in the subject, not the object. So it doesn't apply to other people. In the same way, subjective morality applies only to the subject. It's not valid or binding for anyone else. So, in a world without God, there can be no evil and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. God has expressed his moral nature to us as commands. These provide the basis for moral duties. For example, God's essential attribute of love is expressed in his command to love your neighbor as yourself. This command provides a foundation upon which we can affirm the objective goodness of generosity, self-sacrifice, and equality. And we can condemn as objectively evil greed, abuse, and discrimination. This raises a problem. Is something good just because God wills it, or does God will something because it is good? The answer is neither one. Rather, God wills something because he is good. God is the standard of moral values, just as a live musical performance is the standard for a high fidelity recording.
Without your love.
The more a recording sounds like the original, the better it is. Likewise, the more closely a moral action conforms to God's nature, the better it is. But if atheism is true, there is no ultimate standard. So there can be no moral obligations or duties. Who or what lays such duties upon us? No one. Remember, for the atheist, humans are just accidents of nature, highly evolved animals. But animals have no moral obligations to one another. When a cat kills a mouse, it hasn't done anything morally wrong. The cat's just being a cat. If God doesn't exist, we should view human behavior in the same way. No action should be considered morally right or wrong. But the problem is, good and bad, right and wrong, do exist. Just as our sense experience convinces us that the physical world is objectively real, our moral experience convinces us that moral values are objectively real. Every time you say, hey, that's not fair, That's wrong. That's an injustice. You affirm your belief in the existence of objective morals. We're well aware that child abuse, racial discrimination, and terrorism are wrong. For everybody. Always. Is this just a personal preference or opinion? No. The man who says that it is morally acceptable to rape little children is just as mistaken as the man who says 2 + 2 = 5. What all this amounts to, then, is a moral argument for the existence of God. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But objective moral values and duties do exist. Therefore, God exists. Atheism fails to provide a foundation for the moral reality every one of us experiences every day. In fact, the existence of objective morality points us directly to the existence of God.
Nice. So hopefully that was, if I totally did not make any sense, then hopefully that did. So that's the moral argument. At this time, and we went a little bit longer on that than probably should have, but at this time I'm going to invite the three guys up. So Bobby's going to come back up, and I would also invite you, as I'm talking right now, if you have a question, you can start that line by the microphone. Please ask a question. Otherwise, we're just going to keep talking amongst ourselves, and that might be a little bit awkward. But like I said, Bobby, and then this is Brett Brewster. Brett has been serving on the apologetics team here for a little bit and is finishing his master's degree in Christian apologetics at Southeastern Seminary. And then the guy that just walked up is Connor Boyd. And Connor just finished his master's degree at Dallas Seminary and has just joined the residency as an equipping resident. So he's also going to be, he also serves on the apologetics team. So we'd love to interact with you and any questions that you have. I know a couple of you asked some. I'm going to invite you now to the microphone. We've got about 20 minutes that we'd love to interact with you guys. So tell us your name and your question, and we'll get going.
My name is Morgan. Can you guys hear me?
Everybody? Yep.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, thank you, Nathan and Bobby and everyone else. I really enjoy learning about this stuff because, you know, I have a, you know, 3, 4, 5 friends of mine that are kind of on that negative scale you guys described earlier. Mm-hmm. The one that I engage with the most, I'd say he's like a -3 or something like that. He often brings up arguments. I put lots of stones in his shoe. But he, you know, he still comes back with some other things like, you know, well, you know, Christians say that, you know, young earth or the earth is so young, it's like, what, 5 to 10,000 years old or something mm-hmm. like that. But I see, but I say that the evidence suggests that those that star that's 30 million light years away or something like that, there's no way that light could have gotten to earth unless it was like at least 30 million years old or something like that. So I guess what my question is that like sort of like... an essential, like, do we as Christians like really hold to the belief that we believe that the earth is 5 to 10,000 years old because of biblical records and stuff?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm gonna draw this and then we'll reference this as well throughout the class. So this is something we call like our theological concentric circles. Have any of y'all ever seen me do this before? A couple of you have. All right. Then I'm just trying to gauge how succinctly to go into this. But in the center, I would say that there's, depending on how you do this, but the way I'm going to do it right now, I would say that there's 6 things that belong in the center, okay? And that is, the first one is that God is Trinity. And then out of that, you have to believe that in order to be Christian, you have to believe that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and that the Father is not the Son, and the Son is not the Spirit, and the Spirit is not the Father, but that the Father is God, the Son is God, and the Spirit is God, and there's one God. Okay, that's just a real brief explanation of the Trinity. So people who would deny any part of the Trinity, we would say, hey, you believe something about God, but it's not Christian. Okay, that's what we would say. The other thing is you have to have some sort of belief in sin. So we would say, hey, if you don't believe that anything's wrong, or to use a more word that easily translates into our society today is less than, or not maybe not it is sin, but to call it like dysfunction or something is abnormal or something like that. Like, you have to believe that something has gone wrong. And then I would say you have to believe in the full deity and humanity of Jesus. And the $500 word for that is the hypostatic union. Okay, it just means that Christ is fully man and fully God. So if you deny the divinity of Jesus, or if you deny the humanity of Jesus, then you're no longer in the realm of what's Christian. You also have to believe that that in the atonement, to where in some way Jesus' death fixed sin, and very closely tied to the atonement, so is also the physical resurrection of Jesus, which is why Bobby a second ago referenced the resurrection of Jesus being the centerpiece or the center historical fact of our faith. I mean, probably closely tied to it in one actually act, I would say atonement and resurrection in those. That's five things. And then you have to believe in some sort of resolution, all right? You can't believe that something just continues to, that all the bad stuff continues and God died for everybody's sins but is never going to fully like rectify it and show ultimate justice and make all things anew, right? So I spoke really generally about these six things because there are a bunch of different views that as you unpack them that people hold within Christendom and they're fully Christian, right? But if you take any of these things away, then that's just not Christianity anymore. It's like saying, hey, I want a ham sandwich, but I don't want any bread and I don't want any ham. Well, then you can't have a ham sandwich. Do you see what I'm saying? And so what your friend is asking about, so these are the essentials. I should probably write that up there. essentials, and then the next concentric circle out are what we would call convictions. Essentials are things that you not only break fellowship with people over, but you also tell them, hey, you're not Christian, right? So, I mean, we would say probably some of the things that look like this but are not in the center is like Jehovah's Witnesses. They deny the Trinity. So do Mormons, okay? So while they look Christian, we would say we're not fellowshipping with you in the sense of eating at the same table with you as Christians because you're just not Christian. You're talking about Barney. We're both using the word Barney, but you're talking about a purple dinosaur, and I'm talking about a bumbling deputy in, you know, what was Andy Griffith's show? I know, what's the town called? Mayberry. I was going to say Mayville. I was like, it's not Mayville, Mayberry. Right? However, convictions are things that are not essential, but they're really important, okay? And so these are things that we would say, hey, this is important enough that I'm not saying that you're not Christian, but we also can't fellowship in the same local body together. So some examples of that might be the inerrancy of Scripture, okay? If someone is like, hey, I just don't believe the Bible is God's word, they're probably going to have a hard time coming to church at Watermark, you know? If someone, certain social stands, and I would say not all social stands because not all social society has not elevated every social issue to the point of to the point where, you know, we're having to take a stand against it, right? So there's nothing special about the beaches at Normandy in France, except that's where the Allies met the Axis powers, and there was a massive fight there, right? And so we would say convictions are things that you'd break fellowship with over, but you're not denying that person is still Christian. Like, I have a friend who's an Episcopal deacon. He's openly homosexual. He's married to another man. So if someone was going to press me, I would say he's probably Christian. I think his theology around that is confused, but he's probably Christian. But I don't think we could fellowship at the same local body together because the differences are so large. Do you understand what I'm saying? I know I'm taking a little bit of time, but this is really important, okay? And then the third category is opinions. And opinions are things that, hey, I'm going to, are held to varying degrees. I'm going to hold this strongly or maybe loosely, but it should not ever break fellowship among a local body, right? In this one, I would put like someone's view on election, whether God, you know, did God choose people or did people choose God? Like, I think that's an important issue. And I think some people hold that really strongly, right? If you're like a Westminster Confession kind of guy, then you're going to like burn people at the stake, right? That's a joke. Whatever. We're not burning people at the stake. Although they did one time, but that was a long time ago. Anyway, if you're going to hold that strongly, but I don't think that should ever cause people to like break fellowship with one another among a local body. It's just something you disagree on, right? We agree to disagree. And then the last one are questions. And questions are things that, hey, do your homework, have an opinion on it. Who knows? You know, there are, you know, and in this category, I would put like, what happened to the dinosaurs? And frankly, I think in this category too, like either an opinion or question, I would put the age of the earth, okay? So I said all that just so y'all could see me kind of unpack where like theological ideas have a priority, okay? And what you do not do in apologetics is take a question, opinion, or a conviction and put them into the center. That's where so many people mess up, all right? And people end up tossing the metaphorical baby out with the bathwater. So because they can't reconcile something in one of these three concentric circles, then they end up tossing out the whole thing. And that's where I'm like, a big time, I'm going, time out, right? We don't start with the age of the earth in determining whether Jesus rose from the dead or not, right? That's absurd. And so it's our job, which is why Bobby even said this earlier, it's our job as apologists to gently to gently deal with people's questions, but we're consistently pushing them back to where? Back to the center, right? To ultimately say, hey, I'll answer that question, but, and I've done this with people before on Monday nights where I'm like, hey, I feel like I gave you a satisfactory answer to that question, but now have you ever considered the fact that there was a man 2,000 years ago and he claimed to be God, and he died on a cross, and somehow that meant something, and then he rose from the dead. What do you do with that? And it's really fascinating, guys, to watch people squirm, right, and then deflect that to try to get back to the age of the earth. Because what you've done is you've started to push them into the center where they're forced to make a decision about something that is intensely personal, right? And frankly, it's not just that. It's also, there is a spiritual battle going on. And the enemy does not want you to center on Jesus because that is where people's lives will be radically changed, right? But it's our job as apologists, again, to remove, if people's questions are out here, answer the question. It's great, right? No problem with that. But those are smoke and mirrors. Like what we do is we try to remove those smoke and mirrors so that we can push people to the reality of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So that was a long answer to your question, but I think it's important enough for you guys to see this because this is the way we think as apologists in helping people understand what Christianity is and what's at the center of it and what's not at the center of it, which is frankly what we do a lot of times, is just, that's a good question, but it just doesn't really matter, right? Anyway. So I would say convictions are extremely important things that that would not cause someone to not be a Christian because they embrace all the things in the center, but they are important enough that you would break local fellowship with someone over, right? Which is why I mentioned like the inerrancy issue and embracing homosexuality as an acceptable alternative lifestyle and the things like that. All right, any other questions?
Hello, my name is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
You mentioned earlier, it's a simple, quick question, that everyone contains a moral compass, but the thing I didn't get is like there's people like sociopaths who just don't have a sense of right and wrong. Mm-hmm. They can kill somebody and they don't feel anything about it. So I don't understand like where they fall because you're saying everybody has a moral compass. And I'm like, what about those people?
Yep. I'm going to give you guys a chance. I'll talk way too long. I mean, I'll talk about it if you want, but.
Well, so I'd say on that, sin is in the world and sin perverts things and evil corrupts things and there still is objective moral values. And that's regardless of whether or not people hold to them, whether or not people feel obligated by them. And that can get corrupted by sin and just the junk in the world and the brokenness. And it does. It gets into everything and it destroys it. And people's lives get jacked up the more they spend time following themselves and pointing at themselves, the more jacked up they're going to get. And so it's not even just sociopaths, but it's if I am consistently not following the Lord, then I'm constantly pointing at myself, I'm going to get more and more jacked up and I'm going to care less and less about what God says. But that doesn't change the fact that there are moral values.
Yeah, like I agree that there's objective moral reasoning, but like I feel like some people maybe are just born with like their brain isn't wired the right way.
Yep, yeah, and I would affirm that. Like I do think that people are born with a proclivity or a physiological makeup that makes them predisposed more toward a certain type of behavior. Let's use alcoholism or more sociopathic type behavior like lying or things even worse than that, right? Then I think the burden of proof would be on the person to show that that person never felt any sort of moral responsibility ever in his life. So I would want to see, like, what about the developmental years as a child? What did that look like for that child? What did that? A lot of people like to point to the guy in his 30s that's murdering people and not feeling anything about it without paying attention to the 30 years that preceded that, where there, like Bobby said, there was a consistent turning inward to himself, ignoring social structures that would have applied the objective moral duty and value that he consistently ignored. So we're not saying that people are constantly keeping the moral law. We're saying we're consistently not keeping it. That's the problem, right? But I would not point to that guy and be like, see, it doesn't exist. That's a non sequitur. Yep.
Yeah, I would say one more thing about that. I don't know if you guys have heard of a guy named David Wood. But I would encourage you to write this down, Google him, look it up on YouTube. He's now a Christian apologist. If you've heard of Nabil Qureshi, a Muslim who became a Christ follower, David Wood led him to Christ. And David Wood tells his story. It's about a 30-minute YouTube. He was identified as a sociopath. He tried to murder his father, and he tells a story. It's really compelling, and he came to Christ. And so what I would say is, just like they're saying, when we sin, our conscience gets hardened. Our heart, the Bible says, gets hardened. And so he was identified as a sociopath, but what you'll see is that there really wasn't a wiring problem, but it was just him deciding literally that based on the atheistic worldview, there's nothing wrong so with what I do, right? Just like we were just talking about. So therefore, that kind of makes me God. I can do anything I want. And he kept doing things and not getting challenged on it. And so he just upped the game. And so identified as a sociopath, but in the end, not really at all. So I really suggest you watch that.
Yeah, which is why Paul consistently tells us in the New Testament, I mean, as Christians, we believe the Holy Spirit is always moving, not only in the hearts of believers to transform us in the image of Jesus, but is constantly moving to call people to the reality of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And so Paul says, don't quench the Holy Spirit. Right? Because what happens when you ignore what the Spirit is doing is you turn inward, and like Lewis says in, I think, The Problem of Pain, his book on pain and suffering, he said, when a man turns wholly into himself, what he finds there is hell. You know, and I think that's right.
Well, one other thing to think about is that there are times that there are questions out there that we're not going to have real satisfying answers to, or sometimes we'll think about, okay, well, what about people who haven't heard? And a lot of times, I'm not going to be able to sit up here and tell you, you know, for sure, every one of the 100 billion people who's ever lived, exactly how they heard about Christ, or exactly how they got presented with the opportunity to believe in him, or exactly what that looked like. But we can still go back to, based on what we know and based on what you personally have to choose about the guy named Jesus, you still go back to, okay, you need to decide what you believe about Jesus, because that's, you know, you need to make that decision. And then after that, if we can get over that hump and we can believe that he rose from the dead and that he paid for our sins, then after that, we can trust. And I'm not saying that this just answers all questions and makes it go away, but at the end of the day, I have to trust that we serve a good God who loves people. And so, you know, it sometimes seems like there are people maybe who haven't heard, there are people who it would be hard for them to come to Christ because they have sociopathic tendencies. But at the same time, I do know based on the evidence that I believe in and the case that I've had presented to me, I believe that we have a good God who we can trust, who loves people, and due to his character, I can trust that he is handling that situation well, even if I don't know how that is personally.
All right, we got time for one more. Connor hasn't said anything, so somebody ask Connor a question. Anybody else have anything that's like pressing, like you're like, man, if I don't ask this, I'm going to regret it. Okay, perfect. What's your name?
Hi, I'm Amber.
Hey, Amber.
And I just feel like I have to ask my question now that I put it out to the world.
Yeah, it's good.
So what if something doesn't come from nothing, then where did God come from?
Yeah, it's good. Connor, do you want to take that or do you want to pass it along?
You guys start talking.
Okay. All right. Brett, do you want to tackle that? Bobby and I. Well, you were going to say something. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, if something doesn't come from nothing, where does something come from? That was your question.
Where's God come from?
Yeah. Brett, you want to... you can start, and then we can fill in the gaps.
Right. Well, there's a philosophical argument that you can make that show there can't be an endless series of causes and effects, that it has to end somewhere. But basically, what we believe is God is self-existence, okay? He exists. He just does. He is existence. Everything else he creates. Now, as created beings with limits, we don't really have a way of knowing what that, you know, fully entails, right? But that's the simple answer. God has always been and is existence. So it may not be satisfying to you. You can look at some philosophical arguments that are out there, Thomas Aquinas. There's a whole lot of, you know, ancient philosophers that have thought greatly about this. And you can hear their arguments, and they're very compelling, though sometimes, you know, you have to study them pretty well. But the simple answer is that God just is existence, and everything else is dependent upon him.
Yep. So I would say, too, there's one we didn't cover tonight. It's called the ontological argument that was developed by a guy named Anselm. And basically what Anselm's argument is, if God is God, then he's maximally everything that is good. And one of the things that's necessary for a maximally great being is existence. And so if God was not to exist, if there was a point in time where God did not exist, then he would not be God, which pushes the explanatory ultimate to the next level. Do you see what I'm saying? And that's where you could continue to, like Brett said, you could continue to push that explanatory ultimate to its explanatory end. And what we're saying is what you find at the end of that line is God. And so if God was created, or if there was a time when he did not exist, or if there was a time when he was not maximally great, then he would not be God. We would have to push the explanatory ultimate another level up. Do you see what I'm saying? And so that's why Anselm and others were able to say God is the uncaused cause. He's the unmoved mover, I think is another way they said that. The uncreated creator.
When we look at cause and effect, too, we're so used to everything having a cause, essentially, but really what it is not everything has a cause. It's everything that has a beginning has a cause.
That, yeah,
and God doesn't
right.
have
that's
a
good.
Beginning, and so he doesn't have a cause.
Right, right. Do you want to come to the microphone or just? Well, we're recording it though, so yeah. I'm also paying attention to time, so I'll shut us down in just a minute.
Okay.
More respect your time.
My question is, if Jesus talked about everything and God talked about the beginning, you know, why wasn't this kind of stuff added to it? Why didn't Jesus talk about it? Why wasn't it in scriptures about things about who they, describing who they were before. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so I'll finish yours and then answer that, or try to. And so that the question you ask is actually one I remember from a class I took, and it actually divides the world into the three main religions. Why is there something instead of nothing? Well, atheism says something has always existed, or nature was self-created with time plus space plus chance. And so that's one way to answer that. Pantheism says God is everything and everything is God. And so this stage is God just as much as I am God, as you are God. And so that's another way to answer that. Theism is, well, no, there's an infinite personal God who created us and desires a relationship with us. And so some of these answers we went through tonight, or some of these arguments, are evidences that we're saying, well, if I have a sense of justice, then that must come from somewhere. And some of these scientific arguments are saying, hey, time plus space plus chance, that doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't seem to correspond to reality, to the way things really are. And so there are other answers to that, and we're just saying Christianity is the most reasonable answer to that. And so that was a great question over there. Did you guys have anything to add to that one before?
No, we're good.
And then John 1:1-3, in the beginning was the Word, and that Word is capital W, Jesus Christ. So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. All things were made through him. And so it says, in the beginning, Jesus Christ was with God the Father. And he also says, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven, in Luke 10:19, I believe. And so he, before creation, a lot of people believe that there was an angelic rebellion. And so Jesus is saying, hey, I'm here in the beginning when the angels rebelled. I saw that happen. And then he entered into time in the incarnation. And so he was there in the beginning with God. And that's John 1:1-3. And Jehovah's Witnesses will reinterpret that. That's a whole other issue. Yeah, but it does.
I would say that I would challenge the any kind of belief that when Jesus walked among us that he did not say anything about the origins of the universe. I mean, just like Connor said, I think he said quite a bit. I mean, I know in John 8:58, which is the most explicit claim to deity that Jesus ever made, he's talking with the Pharisees, and he's telling them, they're saying, Abraham is our father, and he's like, well, Abraham saw my day, and he was glad about it. And they were like, dude, you're not even 50 years old yet, and you say you've seen Abraham? And Jesus looks at him, and he's like, hey, guys, before Abraham was even born, I am, right? He's Yahweh. He's the pre-existent one. He's the eternal one, right? He's the one who was there in the beginning. If the Big Bang is the way the world universe was created, then it's the voice of Jesus that started the Big Bang, right? That's what, I'm not saying that we're up here to prove that. I'm saying that that's what Jesus said about himself, right? And we have to deal with that. So, which is a good place for us to stop tonight. And because I think the explanatory ultimate is Jesus, right? But hey, thanks for your time. I know we went over. If you have other questions, you can come up and talk to us. We'll be here as long as you want.
Thanks.
And please come back. It's not too late to register for the class, so you can be our evangelists and bring other people next week.
Take that right there.
Peace.
Come to Great Questions on Monday nights if you want to talk through more stuff. Or email greatquestions@watermark.org, and we'll get lunch with y'all.